Blog Talk Radio.
It was the longest war in U.S. history, spanning an era that saw the Alamo, the Mexican-American War, and the Civil War come and go. It was the 60 years of ongoing battles, fights, and raids that took place between the Great Plains nomadic horse warriors and settlers, traders, and the United States military. With as many as 20,000 casualties on each side, it made the Wild Wild West a dangerous and violent place. It is simply called the Indian Wars. The Southern Plains are perhaps the most storied region of the Wild Wild West. Cattle drives, gunfights, and the home of the Comanche. The Southern Plains extend south from the Arkansas River, to the piney woods on the east, and to the sun-baked deserts on the south and west. They encompass much of present-day Texas, parts of Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, New Mexico, and Mexico. It is a region of short grass prairie and cactus, rolling hills, long stretches of flat terrain, slow-moving rivers and streams that gently cut through the land. Summers are hot and humid, punctuated by fierce thunderstorms and savage tornadoes. Winters are short but dangerous, with occasional powerful sleet and snowstorms. It was a region rich with buffalo, antelope, deer, eagle, and small game. Indeed, in this region, the archaeological record of Native Americans is longer than in any other place on the continent. 13,000 years ago, Paleo-Indians hunted mammoths and mastodons. 3,000 years ago, unknown archaic Indian artists created spectacular rock art in caves. But by 1750, it was the hunting grounds of the Comanche, and later their allies, the Kiowa. This region, for the next 100 years, was called Comancheria. The Comanche were the best horse breeders on the plains. They had the largest pony herds, and many would say they were the most skilled horsemen. A Comanche warrior could ride his horse at full gallop and shoot multiple arrows using the horse's neck as a shield. The Comanche were unique among the Plains Indians tribes in that they were a loose federation of bands, a people with no event that brought them all together on an annual basis. They were also the least constrained by a permanent ruling governmental structure. New leaders could spring up at any time. At one time, the Comanche were a small band of Shoshone Indians living in the Wyoming Basin. In the 1600s, they migrated south along the edge of the Rockies. Obtaining the horse in the early 1700s, they became the powerhouse of the Southern Plains. From its inception, this nomadic horse culture was in constant conflict with the other people of the region. First, it was with the Apache and other native tribes, all of which they defeated and in some cases destroyed. At the same time, they were at odds with non-natives. For nearly 150 years, they defeated the Spanish, the Texans, the Mexicans, and the Americans. Much of their early military success derived from their fighting tactics and warrior ethos. As a warrior society, the Comanche loved to fight. Any Comanche could lead a military action. If a warrior had a good reputation, if he was generous with spoils of war, and if he had powerful medicine, other Comanche warriors would follow him. As with the Northern Plains tribes, war honors, stealing horses and counting coups or touching an enemy, were the highest marks of bravery among the Comanche and their Kiowa allies. Indeed, the bravest act was to count coup on a living enemy. As As a result, the primary goal of Comanche warfare was to score, not to kill. The Comanche initiated military action for three reasons. First, to steal horses and captives. Second, for vengeance. And third, to make war against another Indian tribe. The most frequent action was a raid to steal horses and captives. A raiding party might be as few as four and as many as 100 warriors who would travel up to 400 miles. The worth of a Comanche warrior was measured by the number of horses he had stolen from other tribes. In a vengeance action, a Comanche warrior avenged the death of a friend or relative. This kind of action had a single purpose: to take an enemy scalp to even the score. Once a single scalp was taken, the raiders would turn back, even if spoils were nearby. Returning to camp, success was celebrated by the scalp dance. The third and least frequent action was a war party against another tribe. Often it involved an entire band, with the village moving to a temporary staging area within striking distance of the enemy. The war party leader sent out scouts to gather information. At the right time, the war party went out to begin their attacks. Like the Plains Indians in the north, the Comanche avoided large battles, preferring instead slashing attacks against unsuspecting and weaker targets. The Comanche liked to attack an enemy's flanks in a circling motion. If pursued, the Comanche would spread out, leading their pursuers on a long chase. Or they might split up into smaller groups, rendezvousing at a prearranged location, or by leaving hidden messages for their comrades to find.
Stories of Indian cruelty on the plains were legion, from the Lakota and Cheyenne, Arapaho, Kiowa, Comanche. They were all very cruel to their enemies and to any captives they might have taken. But in particular, the Comanches were said to be one of the worst tribes in this respect. Males that were taken by the Comanches were, if they were not immediately killed, it seemed that one of the favorite tortures would have been to tie them to a wagon wheel upside down and slowly roast them over an open fire. Females had a somewhat different experience. They were usually kept. They were quite good as a commodity here. They were worth many horses, many ponies for the females, taken if they could and saved if they could be saved. The female captives who survived Comanche captivity wrote letters, diaries, and some wrote books of their ordeal, and almost universally it was a horrible ordeal. They were beaten, they were raped, they were starved, tortured, and some of them stayed to be in the tribe and married Comanche husbands. Those that came back again, though, were told of very horrible ordeals. There was a phrase that was very common on the frontier at this time. It was that anyone who was taken captive of an Indian was certain to suffer a fate worse than death. And for females among the Comanches, this appeared to be all too true.
To whites, the Comanche warrior was cruel and savage. But for the Comanche, this behavior was a legitimate part of their warrior code. Interestingly, some captives were treated well and eventually became full-fledged members of the tribe. Superb horsemanship, uncommon bravery, and a desire for personal glory made the Comanche and Kiowa the most daring and effective warriors on the plains. The Comanche version of the Plains Indians Warrior Society would be put to the test with the encroachment of Texans and Americans into Comancheria. It is a little known fact that the Comanche were responsible for preventing the Spanish from developing present-day Texas into a powerful Spanish territory. In an odd twist of fate, the Comanche preserved the southern plains and perhaps the entire West for their ultimate overlords, the United States of America. During the early years of Comancheria, warriors were constantly raiding Spain's Mexican Empire. However, by the 19th century, new events began to unfold on the fringes of Comancheria. The Santa Fe Trail between St. Louis and Santa Fe opened in 1821. A year later, Mexico gained independence from Spain. The Comanches now had new targets for raids, including Americans, who, led by Stephen Austin in 1824, arrived with settlers along the Gulf Coast of Texas. Texas settlers were a new breed of whites for the Comanche. They were hardy frontiersmen and women. Even their children carried guns. Still, they offered raiding opportunities for the Comanche, as well as a trading partner to exchange the Mexican goods pilfered on the western edge of their empire. In 1836, the famous Battle of the Alamo occurred, and within 6 months, the sovereign nation of Texas was founded. An ever-increasing number of settlers poured into Texas, excellent new targets for the Comanche raids. The thinly spread homesteaders were easy targets. The problem was that the old American militia style of response to the Comanche raids was ineffective. The settlers were not horsemen. The answer was the creation of the famous Texas Rangers, horse-mounted gunmen whose sole purpose was to protect farmers and ranchers from the Comanche and Mexicans. These free-ranging gunslingers had no uniforms and were more like Cossacks. In the early 1830s, the Comanche had the upper hand until the arrival of the Colt revolver, the famous repeating handgun of the West. The Rangers, for the first time, had superior firepower to the Comanche bow and arrow. Then, in December 1838, Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar replaced Sam Houston as president of Texas.
Lamar, when he succeeded Houston as president, Houston had a policy of getting along with the Indians and working with them. Lamar's attitude was destroy. We want no Indians in Texas, and Texas will not be safe or peaceful until we have driven all Indians out of Texas. This virtually gave an open season or an open license to warfare or killing and driving out the Indians.
Within the year, what Lamar had called the rat's nest of eastern tribes had been cleaned out of Texas. Turning their attention to the Comanche, the Texas Rangers, now well organized, had one success after another. The hardened veterans rode like the Comanche and fought like the Comanche, but practiced none of the game-like aspects of Comanche warfare. By 1840, the Texas Rangers had proved so devastating that eastern Texas's primary Comanche band, the Panateca, or Honey Eaters, sought a truce.
Comanches and Texans had been fighting for years. By 1840, they decided it was time for a peace. The prerequisite for this meeting was supposed to be that the Comanches would turn in all of their captives. The Comanches brought in to the council house in San Antonio in March 1840, brought in one captive with them. All they brought in was a young girl about 14 years old at the time named Matilda Lockhart. She had been cruelly abused. Her nose had been burned off. There was a black scar and holes where her nose used to be. The Texans were enraged at this. She quickly spilled out her story of abuse and torture, and she told the Texans that there were more captives back in the Comanche village. The Texans asked the Comanches, "Where are your other captives?" Chief Muguara of the Penatecas answered that, "We don't have any captives. They're all spread out amongst the other tribes." Then there was a long silence, and Muguara responded again and said, "How do you like that answer?" That was a big mistake. Texans didn't like that answer at all. They said, "Unless the rest of the captives are going to be delivered immediately, we're going to hold you all as hostages." And with that, soldiers appeared. They appeared outside the building. They appeared in the building. The Indians, of course, were not going to stand for this. The knives were pulled. The arrows and bows were drawn. The soldiers came in. There was a great melee inside the council house. And there was fighting in the streets. The townsfolk were running, screaming, shooting, Indians running through the streets. It took most of the day before all the Indians were either killed or captured. In the end, there were about 7 Texans killed and 8 wounded. There were 35 or so Indians killed and another 27 captured. From that point on, after the council house fight, it was almost impossible to get the Texans and Comanches together. The violence increased after that point.
After the council house fight, widespread Comanche raiding intensified on Texas's coastal plain. Then, unexpectedly, there was a lull. Many Texans believed the Comanche had learned their lesson. Instead, the Comanche were preparing for all-out war against the Texans, who at this time were still an independent nation. The leader of the soon-to-be war was a chief called Buffalo Hump. In fact, he was the Honey Eaters Band's only great war chief left after the Council House fight. But in Comanche tradition, he had a vision that the Texans could be driven out of Comancheria. The call went out for war throughout the Comanche Empire. The response was poor. Only a few Kiowa and young Comanche warriors from northern bands responded. Nevertheless, Chief Buffalo Hump pulled together a war party of over 400 and planned an extensive campaign against the Texans. By August of 1840, he was ready. It would be the first Comanche war party against whites. His tactics were flawless. He bypassed the Texan stronghold San Antonio undetected. Buffalo Hump surprised the town of Victoria, killed several people, and moved on towards the coastal region of Texas. When the Comanche reached Lynnville, they discovered the townspeople had abandoned the port. They sacked the town and looted a warehouse full of goods, which included a shipment of iron barrel hoops that could be used for making arrowheads. So devastating was the raid, the Texans never rebuilt the town. At this point, with so much loot, the war party deteriorated. What happened next went totally against all Comanche military tactics. Having won a great victory at no cost to themselves, they should have run their ponies hard into the sunset. Buffalo Hump knew this, but he could not refuse sharing in this incredible treasure. So the war party departed Lynnville in a slow-moving caravan of loaded-down horses and mules. By now, the Texas Rangers and militia, led by General Felix Houston, were gathering their forces. Houston quickly understood what was happening. The Comanche were done with war and were slowly heading towards their home territory. By pushing his men hard, he could cut them off at a place called Plum Creek. On August 11th, 1840, a battle ensued. It was the most bizarre sight in all the Indian wars. Wearing top hats and carrying umbrellas, the Comanche became trapped in their caravan of horses and mules. Uncertain whether to protect their stash of goods, fight or run, they suffered a bitter defeat. In the end, 80 warriors were dead and one Texan was killed. The Comanche lost their loot, which interestingly the Texans now divided amongst themselves. However, Buffalo Hump's war guaranteed a fight to the death over who would control Texas. Chief Buffalo Hump escaped the Plum Creek fight and held out against the Texans for another 6 years, finally signing a peace treaty. From then on, he led his people to a series of reservation stops until they ended up in 1859 at the present-day location of the Comanche Kiowa Reservation in Oklahoma. Buffalo Hump died 11 years later. At the time of Buffalo Hump's war, the Kiowa and Comanche were thriving in the north. The Comanche's only ally were the Kiowa. a nation of approximately 2,000 individuals, but with an equally fierce warrior tradition. The Kiowa had arrived on the northern plains from Canada and lived in the Black Hills region of South Dakota. After the Cheyenne and Sioux drove them out, they journeyed on to the southern plains and into Comancheria. At first, the Comanche regarded them as trespassers, and the two nations fought a bloody war. But by the beginning of the 19th century, they formed a military alliance that bound them together even into the present. Unlike the loosely organized Comanche, the Kiowa were a highly structured military society. The tribe was governed by a council of chiefs made up of leaders from the tribe's bands. Most often, these chiefs were men who had achieved military or diplomatic honors. Kiowa warriors also found honor in stealing horses and counting coup on enemies. Frequently, they raided nearby tribes or went south into Texas and Mexico, striking ranches for ponies and captives. By this time, Kiowa lands included parts of the present-day Texas Panhandle, a wide expanse of short grass prairie and cactus carved by a few shallow waterways. Called the Llano Estacado, or the Staked Plains, it is the southernmost reach of the High Plains. The plains end here at a steep ridge that drops off into haunting red earth badlands. It is also a primary north-south migration route for the buffalo and the final stronghold for the Kiowa and Comanche. It was here in 1864, at a deserted trading post called Adobe Walls, that the Kiowa fought their most famous battle against the legendary frontier trapper and explorer, Christopher Kit Carson. A year earlier, Carson, a hero in the mold of George Rogers Clark and Daniel Boone, had defeated the Navajo with his Scorched Earth campaign. In 1864, General James H. Carleton, military commander of the Department of New Mexico, ordered Colonel Carson to attack Indian villages along the Canadian River in the Staked Plains.
In the fall of 1864, Kit Carson left Fort Bascom, New Mexico Territory, with about 300 men of the New Mexico Cavalry and California Cavalry. He was heading east looking for Kiowa and Comanches, who had been raiding along the Santa Fe Trail that year. He got into the Texas Panhandle on the Canadian River, a place called Adobe Walls, an old fort, an old trading post that George Bent had been decayed for about 20 years or more here now. He found a village of little mountains, Kiowas, and he pretty much drove the Indians out of the area, kept going downstream. Pretty soon there was about 1,000 Kiowa and Comanches from Stumbling Bear's village and others that confronted him there, and all of a sudden the tables were turned, and it was Carson who was on the defensive. If it were not for Lieutenant George Pettis and his two mountain howitzers, Carson may have been the one that was massacred there. In the end, the Indians won. Carson had to leave the field.
After the battle, tensions remained high between the ever-growing number of immigrants and traders and the Indians along the Santa Fe Trail. In 1867, attempting to reach an accord, the United States government called for a peace commission with Comanche, Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Kiowa leaders at Medicine Lodge Creek, 60 miles south of Fort Larned, Kansas. The peace plan called for a great reservation south of the Arkansas River. In addition, the tribes would be given cattle herds and taught to grow crops. The Kiowa war chiefs Osantank, Santanta, and Lone Wolf were uneasy about agreeing to the treaty. However, the tribe moved onto the reservation. The Medicine Lodge Treaty was largely a failure. Kiowa warriors continued to raid outside of the reservation, just as the whites failed to enforce their side of the bargain. Then in 1871, a Kiowa raid called the Salt Creek Massacre changed U.S. policy towards Indians and sealed the fate of the Kiowa Nation. In May of 1871, most of the famous Kiowa war chiefs left the Fort Sill Reservation and headed south into Texas. The war leader was a Kiowa prophet known as Mamanti, who had predicted a great victory. The raiding party watched the road between Fort Griffin and Fort Richardson. On May 18th, an army ambulance with a small escort traveled by. Though the other Kiowa wanted to attack, Mamonti assured them that a bigger prize was coming. Unknown to the Indians, the passenger in the ambulance was none other than General William Tecumseh Sherman, architect of the Army's total war policy against the Indians. A few hours later, a 10-wagon mule train showed up. The Indians attacked, overrunning the teamsters on the first charge, killing seven and letting the rest escape. It was the last great successful raid by the Kiowa. Returning to Fort Sill, Santanta, Big Tree, and Osantank were arrested for the raid. On the way to Jacksboro, Texas, to stand trial, Santank managed to escape. He killed one guard before a soldier shot him. Big Tree and Santanta were found guilty and sentenced to death. The governor of Texas, fearing the Kiowa might go to war if the chiefs were executed, commuted their sentences to life in prison. Only the Kiowa war leader, Lone Wolf, escaped punishment. After the Salt Creek Massacre, he fled south and joined with Quanah Parker's Guahati Comanche in the unsuccessful Second Battle of Adobe Walls on June 27, 1874. After the defeat at Plum Creek in 1840, external events moved against the Comanche. Texas became part of the United States in 1845 and could now bring the full force of the U.S. military to bear on the Comanche. But the most devastating event was the discovery of gold in California in 1848. Within a year, 100,000 gold seekers traveled west. For many years, prior to the gold rush, the Comanche had been smart about contact with whites and avoided their deadly diseases. But outbreaks of smallpox in 1848 and cholera in 1849 decimated the Comanche nation, whose population dropped from an estimated 20,000 in mid-century to just 8,000 by 1876. After that, the scope of raiding parties diminished. In the late 1860s, even though many of the northern bands agreed to restrict their activities to reservations in central Oklahoma, they did not. This really meant becoming a non-Comanche, something they could not do. As long as they had horses, they would hunt the buffalo and raid they did. After the Civil War, they had a new target, the vast cattle drives along the Chisholm and other trails. They also frequently targeted the stagecoach road from Fort Smith, Arkansas, through Texas to El Paso. Finally, Philip Sheridan ordered the cavalry to sweep through the reservation set up by the Medicine Lodge Treaty of 1867, and then invade the last Comanche stronghold, the Staked Plains, in the panhandle of Texas. Here they became aware of the Comanche chief known as Quanah Parker. Quanah Parker was half white. His mother, Cynthia Parker, had been captured by the Caddo tribe when she was 9 and then traded to the Comanche. As an adult, Cynthia Parker adopted the Comanche way of life, married one of its chiefs, and had a son, Quanah Parker. At the age of 15, he joined the powerful Comanche Quahati Band and became a war chief. This new leader fearlessly led charges against the cavalry, capturing many of their horses and killing and scalping a soldier. While Sheridan's 1868 military campaign was less than successful, another white enterprise was. Teams of buffalo hunters and skinners were rapidly exterminating the last of the once immense southern herds. The team's best marksmen would create what was called a stand, by killing the herd leader. The herd then stood about, leaderless and confused, unable to go anywhere, while the rest of the hunters, using powerful new guns with telescopic sights, easily picked them off, one by one. The hunters were interested only in the buffalo skins, which were sold back east. From 1872 to 1874, hunters killed over 3.5 million animals, virtually destroying the buffalo and driving them near to extinction. General Sheridan remarked about the professionals, "Let them kill, skin, and sell until the buffalo is exterminated, as it is the only way to bring lasting peace and allow civilization to advance." When the buffalo hunters reached the Staked Plains and set up camp at the old battle site of Adobe Walls, Quinine Parker called for war. For the first time, the Comanche held a sun dance, hoping to attract the Cheyenne and Arapaho. The ceremony worked, and in June of 1874, Quinine Parker led a force of Kiowa, Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Comanche against the buffalo hunters. But victory was not to be his. The Allied forces were repelled by the buffalo hunters' superior weapons.
Randall McKenzie, in late September 1874, led about 600 troopers of the 4th Cavalry and 10th Infantry into the Staked Plains of Texas, hunting Comanches, Kiowas, and Cheyenne. He found them hidden deep inside the recesses of Paladero Canyon, which is about a dozen or so miles south of present-day Amarillo, Texas. They trailed them up into the edge of the wall of the canyon. The Indian village lay below them about 500 feet down. McKenzie started his troopers down along the wall. The Indians saw them, too. They figured they would never get down, and they were a little lackadaisical about preparing for them. But McKenzie snaked them in down 500 feet of canyon wall into the village, into the valley. At that time, the Indians panicked, and they ran. McKenzie's soldiers attacked the village. There were only about 4 Indians killed, and just a handful of McKenzie's troopers were hit. But the main significance of this fight here lies in the aftermath. The village was destroyed. There were buffalo robes. There was a supply of winter food that was destroyed. McKenzie captured about 2,000 ponies. He kept 600 for himself and his men, and he killed 1,400 ponies. The Indians knew that their time was about up here. Winter was approaching. Their supplies and ponies were gone, and their secret-most hideout had been found. They either had to go to the reservation or starve, and finally many of them started heading to the reservation.
The wheel had come full circle. Gone were the buffalo. Gone were the Mustang herds. And gone were the nomadic warrior tribes of the southern plains. Once again, they became sedentary farmers. Still, one more series of battles would be fought against U.S. troops by the Comanches' old nemesis, the Apache. The desert southwest is a region that covers most of present-day Arizona and New Mexico, a land of dramatic landscapes, cliffs and canyons, a land of deserts and mountains, cactus and scrub. It is also the driest and hottest region of the United States. Animal life is scarce. The region is the ancestral home of the ancient Anasazi, Hohokam, and Mogollon, cultures that left behind spectacular ruins and art. For many, it is the area where Native American culture still has a profound presence. It is the area of the largest Indian reservations. When the Spanish explorers entered the region around 1540, they found two kinds of native lifestyles: agricultural people, the Zuni, Pueblo, and Hopi, who were such highly skilled farmers that they were capable of supporting large populations and permanent villages. The other lifestyle, typified by the Apache, were nomadic hunters who often preyed on their sedentary neighbors. prehistoric Apache ranged over a large region. By the end of the 1500s, they had a new target for their raids, the Spanish. Though never mounting a revolt against the new explorers and settlers like the Pueblo, the Apache constantly raided them for their horses and cattle. Then in 1848, Mexico ceded its northern territory to the United States, including Apache land. The stage was set for a 25-year guerrilla war between the Apache and the United States. One of the most dramatic moments in this war occurred in 1861 in what has been referred to as the Bascom Affair. It involved Cochise, perhaps the best-known chief of all the Indian Wars. Never photographed, he had been an advocate of peace until he and his villagers were wrongly accused of kidnapping children and cattle from John Ward's ranch.
In late October of 1860, Coyotero Apaches raided John Ward's ranch, which was located on the very southern border of Arizona, across from Old Mexico. They stole his livestock, and they stole his 12-year-old stepson, who became later known as Mickey Free. The Indians that were blamed, although they may have been Coyoteros, the Chiricahuas were blamed under Cochise. John Ward went to Fort Buchanan nearby and asked for help to get his livestock back and his stepson. Leaving Fort Buchanan was Lieutenant George Bascom with a number of 7th Infantry men. Thinking that Cochise had taken the stock and the boy, he marched east to the Chiricahua Mountains, where Cochise was known to be staying. He arranged a meeting with Cochise, and Cochise agreed to meet with him. Bascom moved into Siphon Canyon and set his tents up, which was just a little bit east of Apache Pass. Cochise came in with his family, not expecting anything to happen. He went into the tent and met with Bascom. Bascom confronted him and said, "Where's the livestock? Where's the boy of John Ward that you stole?" Well, Cochise didn't know anything about it. He didn't do it. But he said that if you give me about 10 days, I can probably find the boy for you. Bascom said that, well, that would be fine, but he was going to hold his family hostage in the meantime. Well, that didn't go over well with Cochise at all. He pulled out a knife, slid open the tent that he was in, ran out the backside and up the hill amidst a barrage of firing from the soldiers. The affair was known later as either the Cut the Tent Affair or the Bascom Affair. And it became a point in our history of where we can consider probably that the Apache Wars really began from that point on.
Cochise then took his own hostage, James F. Wallace, a station attendant of the Butterfield Stagecoach line. Over the next 2 weeks, the Bascom Affair escalated rapidly. The Apache raided ranches and mail coaches. Bascom took more hostages. When the lieutenant refused to release Cochise's relatives, the Apache leader killed Wallace and mutilated his body so badly he could only be identified through the fillings in his teeth. On February 19th, Bascom retaliated by hanging 3 of Cochise's relatives. Thus began a bloody guerrilla war that lasted for 25 years. Cochise and his father-in-law, Mangus Coloradus, vowed to drive the whites from Arizona. They raided ranches, mining camps, and mail coaches, virtually halting all immigration into the area. For a brief time, Arizona was once again Apache territory. And then in 1862, Mangus and Cochise learned that Union General James H. Carleton was marching 1,800 men east from California to New Mexico. They gathered together the largest single force of Apache ever assembled, over 700 warriors. At Apache Pass, they laid a trap.
Apache Pass in southeastern Arizona was a strategic point. It was located between the Dos Cabezos Mountains and the Chiricahua Mountains on the north and south, and between the Chihuahuan Desert and the Sonoran Desert on the east and west. And in between, right in the middle of the pass, was a little spring of fresh water that was very important to any travelers who were coming through the area. They almost always had to go through Apache Pass. that this time there was a column of California troops under James Carleton going to marching to New Mexico to fight the rebels, and the Indians knew it. Cochise, Mangus Coloradus assembled a great force of Apache warriors in the pass waiting for the troops to arrive. The first advance guard of about 120 or so men of the California infantry under Lieutenant Thomas Roberts approached the pass without warning. Suddenly, shots were fired from near the spring and from the mountainsides on both sides of the pass. Roberts couldn't dislodge the Indians. They were firing from all around him. He backed off into the valley a bit, opened up with his two mountain howitzers, and started blasting shells into the rocks. The exploding shells and the jagged pieces of flying rock finally drove the Indians away, drove them back out a distance away where Roberts could move up into the pass and take the water hole. The next day, Carleton came up with the main force and had to fight his way in again, but they eventually secured the pass.
After this fight, the Apache never again fought en masse, preferring to attack small groups of miners, undefended ranches, and unwary travelers, often killing, and in the tradition of the Plains Indians, mutilating their victims. A year later, Mangus Coloradus was killed. Cochise continued to fight on until 1874, when he suddenly fell ill and died in his home mountains near Apache Pass. But other warriors who had fought alongside him from the beginning rose to take his place. Nana, Chato, Victorio, and Geronimo. Victorio, born in New Mexico's Black Range Mountains in 1825, became a leader of the Chiricahua Apache after Mangus Coloradus' death. He quickly became an effective guerrilla raider. Then in 1869, he settled down on a Chiricahua reservation in New Mexico. For 8 years, he was at peace. But when the U.S. government ordered him to the infamous San Carlos Reservation in Arizona, he left the hated place with 250 warriors and turned renegade. Over the next 3 years, he and his followers raided throughout Arizona and Mexico, killing over 400 whites. Then on October 15, 1880, he and his men were surrounded in Chihuahua, Mexico, and were wiped out by Mexican troops under the command of Colonel Joaquin Terrazas. However, it was Geronimo who would go down in Western history as the ultimate Indian renegade. Geronimo was born in 1829 and rose to become the leader of the Chiricahua Apache. He was known as Goyafle, one who yawns, but his life was far from commonplace. The slaughter of his family by Mexican troops when he was a young man turned him from peace to war against the whites. He was a complex and philosophical man. He once said, "I cannot think we are useless, or God would not have created us. There is one God looking down on us all. We're all children of one God. The sun, the darkness, the winds are all listening to what we have to say." To his followers, he was a powerful medicine man who could see into the future and walk without leaving footprints. Still, from the beginning of the Apache guerrilla wars in 1861, he regularly raided ranches and American settlements until his final capture. To whites, his raids were brutal and savage. Then in 1884, General George Crook, the U.S. Army's most celebrated Indian fighter, persuaded Geronimo to return to the San Carlos Apache Reservation. In his 1884 report to the War Department, Crook stated, "For the first time in the history of that fierce people, every member of the Apache tribe is at peace." But peace was short-lived. In May of 1885, Geronimo bolted again. After leaving the reservation, he attacked the Phillips ranch, killing three of the family and leaving their five-year-old daughter hanging from a meat hook. General Crook went after him, but the wily Apache war leader escaped. As a result, Crook was relieved of command and replaced by General Nelson Miles, a hero of many Indian campaigns. Miles assembled an incredible force of 5,000 troops to hunt down Geronimo. Still, Geronimo continued to raid. Hysteria, aided by lurid and exaggerated newspaper accounts, swept the Southwest and the entire country. When it came, the end was strangely subdued. In August 1886, an intrepid young lieutenant, Charles Gatewood, walked into Geronimo's camp in the Sierra Madre Mountains of Mexico and persuaded him to surrender. The Indian Wars ended on that day. So feared was Geronimo that President Grover Cleveland recommended he be hanged. Instead, he was sent to prison in Marion, Florida. In 1894, Geronimo was allowed to return to Fort Sill, where he dictated to S.S. Barrett his autobiography, Geronimo, His Own Story. Geronimo died there in 1909.
Hello, I'm Kevin Costner. Welcome to 500 Nations. The settling of this country has always been of interest to me. It's fired my imagination and shaped my life both personally and professionally. But my knowledge of history has been limited by what I was taught. As far as I was concerned, the history of the continent started 500 years ago when Columbus discovered the New World. But we know that's not true. There were people here. So how is it we know so little about this past, the human history of North America, our own story? Could it be that we don't think it worthy of mention, the way history has remembered the ancient civilizations of Greece, Rome, Egypt, or China? The truth is, we have a story worth talking about. We have a history worth celebrating. Long before the first Europeans arrived here, there were some 500 nations already in North America. They blanketed the continent from coast to coast, from Central America to the Arctic. There were tens of millions of people here speaking over 300 languages. Many of them lived in beautiful cities, among the largest and most advanced in the world. In the coming hours, 500 Nations looks back on these ancient cultures, how they lived and how many survived. We turn for guidance to hundreds of Indian people across the continent. You'll meet many of them in our programs. To bring the past alive, we searched archives for the oldest and most authentic images of Indian people. We sought out rare books and manuscripts for the actual words of participants and eyewitnesses to history. Our camera crews traveled throughout North America to film at the actual places where important events in Indian history occurred. We filmed incredible treasures of Indian creativity from museums across North America and Europe. Historians and archaeologists work with visual artists and advanced computer technology to allow us for the first time to walk through virtual realities of ancient Indian worlds. What you're about to see is what happened. It's not all that happened, and it's not always pleasant. We can't change that. We can't turn back the clock. But we can open our eyes and give the First Nations of this land the recognition and respect they deserve, their rightful place in the history of the world. With that in mind, we take you first to where our story ends, on the Great Plains in the late 1800s.
The rumor got about the school. The dead are to return. The buffalo are to return. The Lakota people will get back their own way of life. That part about the dead returning was what appealed to me. To think I should see my dear mother, grandmother, brothers and sisters again. But boy-like, I soon forgot about it. Until one night when I was rudely awakened in the dormitory.
Get up. Put your clothes on and slip downstairs. We are running away.
A boy was hissing into my ear. Soon 50 of us little boys, about 8 to 10, started out across country, over hills and valleys, running all night. I know now that we ran almost 30 miles. There on the Porcupine Creek, thousands of Lakota people were in camp.
By the late 1880s, a message of hope spread across the Great Plains. It was called the Ghost Dance, a dance to restore the past when Indian nations were free.
They danced without rest, on and on. Occasionally, someone thoroughly exhausted and dizzy fell unconscious into the center and lay there dead. The visions ended the same way, like a chorus describing a great encampment of all the Lakotas who had ever died, where there was no sorrow, but only joy, where relatives thronged out with happy laughter. The people went on and on and could not stop. And so I suppose the authorities did think they were crazy. But they weren't. They were only terribly unhappy.
Driven off their lands, Indian nations were confined to desolate reservations, dependent on corrupt government agencies for food and supplies.
The people were desperate from starvation. We felt that we were mocked in our misery. We held our dying children and felt their little bodies tremble as their souls went out and left only a dead weight in our hands. Red Cloud, Oglala.
The ghost dance hurt no one, But as it spread, white settlers panicked. The United States government outlawed the dance.
The white men were frightened and called for soldiers. We had begged for life, and the white men thought we wanted theirs.
On a mild day just after Christmas of 1890, a band of Hukwoju Sioux, under their leader Bigfoot, left the Cheyenne River Agency in South Dakota, heading for a meeting at Pine Ridge with Oglala leader Red Cloud. Traveling with Bigfoot were 106 men and 252 women and children. Among them was a boy, Dewey Beard, who would later tell his children and grandchildren about that day.
Grandpa Dewey Beard being the last survivor, I would listen to what he had to say. In a way, it was sad, and yet it's beautiful because it's bringing back history. One thing that he would say is that had the soldiers, had the government left them alone, in time they would have looked outside and seen how things were changing, and the change would come about from within the bands.
Bigfoot's band was intercepted by the 7th Cavalry. The officer in charge found Bigfoot wrapped in heavy blankets, dying from pneumonia in the back of a wagon. Bigfoot was ordered to make camp along Wounded Knee Creek. In the morning, his people would be stripped of their weapons and escorted to Pine Ridge. Bigfoot made assurances of his peaceful intentions, and the band made camp.
He's a peaceful man. He's always say that, think about the elderly, think about the children and the woman. And don't start the trouble.
Morning broke after a sleepless night surrounded by soldiers. Hukwoju witnesses would later recall what happened next.
Bigfoot, who was sick, came up with a flag of truce tied to a stick. Dewey Beard.
As soldiers trained their guns on them, Bigfoot and his men brought forth all their weapons, placing them near the white flag of truce Bigfoot had planted in front of his lodge. The soldiers then searched their tents and wagons for arms, even confiscating cooking and sewing tools. As Bigfoot's people gathered around the flag of truce outside his tent, four powerful Hotchkiss rapid repeating guns were mounted above the camp.
I noticed that they were erecting cannons up here, also hauling up quite a lot of ammunition for it.
They encircled us like a band of sheep.
I could see that there was commotion amongst the soldiers, and I saw on looking back, they had their guns in position, ready to fire.
Thomas Tibbles, a white reporter who followed the troops to Wounded Knee, recorded what happened next.
Suddenly I heard a single shot from the direction of the troops. Then three or four, a few more, and immediately a volley. At once came a general rattle of rifle firing, then the Hotchkiss guns.
An awful noise was heard, and I was paralyzed for a time. Then my head cleared, and I saw nearly all the people on the ground, bleeding. My father, my mother, my grandmother, my older brother, and my younger brother were all killed.
And he saw his mother walking toward him. She was walking along, and she was shot. Dewey, she said, keep walking, my son. She said, keep going. She said, I'm going to die. And that was the last time he saw his mother.
The women, as they were fleeing with their babies, were killed together, shot right through. And after most of them had been killed, a cry was made, that all those not killed or wounded should come forth and they would be safe. Little boys came out of their places of refuge, and as soon as they came in sight, a number of soldiers surrounded them and butchered them there. American Horse, Oglala.
The firing continued for an hour or two, wherever a soldier saw a sign of life. With the sunset, the weather turned intensely cold. About 7 o'clock that night, the 7th Cavalry brought in the long train of dead and wounded soldiers and Indians from Wounded Knee. 49 wounded Sioux women and children had been piled into a few old wagons.
The wounded Indian women and children were eventually carried into an agency church, where they lay in silence on the floor beneath a pulpit decorated with a Christmas banner reading, "Peace on Earth, Goodwill to Men."
Nothing I have seen in my whole life ever affected or depressed or haunted me like the scenes I saw that night in that church. One unwounded old woman held a baby on her lap. I handed a cup of water to the old woman, telling her, "Give it to the child," who grabbed it as if parched with thirst. As she swallowed it hurriedly, I saw it gush right out again. A blood-stained stream through a hole in her neck. Heartsick, I went to find the surgeon. For a moment, he stood there near the door, looking over the mass of suffering and dying women and children. Oh, the silence. The silence they kept was so complete, it was oppressive. And then, to my amazement, I saw that the surgeon, who I knew had served in the Civil War, attending the wounded from Wilderness to Appomattox, he began to grow pale. "This is the first time I've seen a lot of women and children shot to pieces," he said, "and I can't stand it." Thomas Tibbles, reporter.
For 3 days, the frozen bodies of the dead, including Bigfoot, lay where they fell at Wounded Knee. Finally, the army dug a large trench at the massacre site. Then, as they collected the bodies, a blanket was seen moving. Beneath it, snuggled against her dead mother, was a baby girl.
The official military history is called Wounded Knee, the last battle in the Indian Wars. But the tenacious struggle for Indian survival, as symbolized by a child clinging to life for 3 days on a frozen field, continues to this day. 500 Nations will follow a path that covers thousands of years and will bring us full circle to 1890. In this hour, we will travel back in time to three stunning civilizations that flourished long before the arrival of Europeans. To the Anasazi of the Southwest, the mound builders of the Mississippi, and the great pyramid builders of the Maya. But when we return, we'll go back even farther, to creation, as seen through the eyes of Indian people.
When Earth was still young and giants still roamed the Earth, a great sickness came upon them. All of them died, except for a small boy. One day while he was playing, a snake bit him. The boy cried and cried. The blood came out, and finally he died. With his tears, our lakes became. With his blood, the red clay became. With his body, our mountains became. And that was how Earth became. Taos Pueblo.
Pleasant it looked, this newly created world. Along the entire length and breadth of the earth, our grandmother extended the green reflection of her covering, and the escaping odors were pleasant to inhale. Winnebago.
God created the Indian country, and that was the time this river started to run. Then God created fish in this river and put deer in the mountains. Then the Creator gave Indians life. We walked. And as soon as we saw the game and fish, we knew they were made for us. My strength, my blood is from the fish, from the roots and berries and game. I did not come here. I was put here by the Creator. Menainik Yakima.
In the Old Testament, Adam and Eve were forced from the Garden of Creation and expelled to a cruel world. For most North American Indian nations, it was and is very different. They stayed in the garden, the place of their creation, the single place on earth most perfect for them.
The Crow Country is a good country. The Creator has put it exactly in the right place. While you are in it, you fare well. Whenever you go out of it, whichever way you travel, you fare worse. The Crow Country is exactly in the right place. Alapuish, Crow.
There is a song in everything. Madegs. Kim Shen.
Make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunsets. Make me wise so that I may know the things you have taught my people, the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. Make me ever ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eye, so that when life fades as the fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. Tom White Cloud, Ojibwe.
To the outsider, the sun-beaten deserts of the American Southwest are a harsh and unforgiving land, reluctant to support life. To the ancient people who lived there, it was a place where the Creator provided everything.
There is nothing there that you can see, even to this day. Very little vegetation, see a lot of rocks, see a lot of sand. The Hopis have always maintained that that's a chosen place for them. It was chosen for them by the Creator, the Great Spirit, for the Hopis.
The ancient people of the desert were the ancestors of all the modern Pueblo nations. To their Hopi descendants, they are known as the Hisatsunan. But to most of the world, they are known by the Navajo name, Anasazi. Around 900 A.D., the Anasazi flourished in a wide circle covering parts of modern-day Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico. The Anasazi found balance with their world. They learned where to find water and how to harness it. Villages joined together to build dams, reservoirs, and irrigation canals, turning deserts into gardens of corn and squash. They were a people intimately connected to their land. In a very real sense, they emerged from it. Generations before the time of Christ, the Anasazi lived in subterranean pit houses, sunken homes with stonework walls and broad, strong roofs. Formidable protection against the searing sun and bitter cold of the desert. With time, they adapted their above-ground storage houses into living spaces. But the underground pit houses were not abandoned. They were retained as spiritual places of teaching. The place of origin. The Kiva. 100 years before the first Gothic cathedrals were built in Europe, the master architects and stonemasons of the Anasazi were building great kivas that could hold 500 people. Around 900 AD, the Anasazi leadership embarked upon a bold and visionary plan. Create a Mecca for pilgrimages and a focal point for trade at the very center of their land. They chose the barren, treeless Chaco Canyon, 100 miles northwest of present-day Albuquerque, New Mexico. It was a monumental undertaking. They built 400 miles of distinctive graded roads and broad avenues, all leading to the canyon. At distant points, signal stations were constructed where fires blazed to communicate across the vastness of the desert and to guide travelers at night. Over 50,000 trees were cut down in the surrounding mountains to build the towns of Chaco Canyon. Along with traders and pilgrims, the roads carried resources to maintain dozens of communities. None compared with the largest single complex the Anasazi ever built. Pueblo Bonito, the wonder of the canyon. At its peak, Pueblo Bonito's 800 rooms may have housed over 1,000 residents. Some sections overlooking the main plaza loomed 5 stories above the canyon floor. The plaza pulsated with life. Women gathered the colored corn blanketing the rooftops and knelt in rows to grind it. Children played. Men returning from the fields gathered to talk. Thirty-seven sacred kivas scattered throughout the complex speak to Pueblo Bonito's rich ceremonial life. During ceremonies, the feet of dancers pounded the ground smooth as spectators huddled against buildings and thronged the roofs to watch. But Chaco Canyon was more than a spiritual Mecca. It was also a center of trade and commerce. And trade in one stone, more valuable to Chaco's Mexican trading partners than gold or jade, was the engine of the canyon's economic growth. Turquoise. Here, raw stone arrived from distant mines for the craftsmen of Pueblo Bonito to cut and shape into small tiles and beads, which were then traded south to merchant centers in the heart of Mexico. There they were transformed into extraordinary creations. For 150 years, trade fueled the Chaco economy, but the wealth and power of the canyon was fleeting. Chaco's major turquoise consumer, Tolan, in central Mexico, fell to civil strife. Extended drought or hostilities also may have contributed to the downfall of Chaco Canyon. By 1150, it was in decline. The great turquoise road over the Mexican High Sierra abandoned. But the Anasazi world still flourished. The people of Chaco Canyon, simply moved to other locations. Many went north to Mesa Verde, which at that time was reaching its cultural and architectural height. There, under the shelter of the pine-studded mesas of southern Colorado, the architects of Chaco Canyon would help create some of the most stunning buildings of all time. The largest of these is known as Cliff Palace, though it is a palace in name only. These beautiful stone buildings of the Anasazi were home to common families. It was a society based on equality. Men rotated service on public works. Women plastered houses. The man who farmed also carved. Spiritual leaders tilled the fields.
Each time when I see and visit any ancient dwelling, I feel close because these are my ancestors, my forefathers for centuries. A feel of meditation, looking at their dwellings. Within few minutes, half hour, I get refreshed.
The people of Mesa Verde and many other Anasazi towns relocated around 1300. The period of the ancestors came to an end, and the modern-day Pueblo world took shape. Traditions that live today in the American Southwest, the way of life, the architecture, the religion, are the resonance of a heritage reaching back thousands of years.
Send a prayer to the sun. So he called on his friend the bear, and the bear came and he said, "Oh, I'm very honored to be asked to do this, but I can only take it to the top of the highest tree. But I know someone who can. So let's call Eagle." And so Eagle was called, and Eagle said, "Yes, I can try." And so Eagle flew and flew and flew up, 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 and got to the sun and delivered the prayer. And the sun was so taken with this, said, "Give me one of your feathers." And so the eagle plucked out a tail feather and gave it to the sun, and the sun kissed that feather, which is why, you know, eagle feathers are black on the end, and it's because the sun sends them there. He said, "Take this back, and forever this will be my recognition of my special people."
Along the Mississippi River, 6 miles from present-day St. Louis, Missouri, there stood a city that once dominated the heart of the continent. At its center was a powerful leader.
A great number of years ago, there appeared among us a man who came down from the sun. This man told us that he had seen from on high that we did not govern ourselves well, that we had no master, that each of us had presumption enough to think himself capable of governing others, while he could not even conduct himself.
1,000 years ago, the great sun, a leader who was both king and pope, lived atop a man-made royal mountain 10 stories high, its 16-acre base larger than any pyramid in Egypt.
He told us that in order to live in peace among ourselves, we must observe the following points. We must never kill anyone but in defense of our own lives. We must never know any woman besides our own. We must never take any things that belong to another. We must never lie. nor get drunk. We must not be avaricious. We must give generously and with joy and share our subsistence with those who are in need of it.
From the heights of his royal estate, the great sun mediated between the Creator and the people, between the sun and the earth. This is Cahokia, city of the sun. The great sun ruled the thriving center of a vast Mississippian culture. Outside the walled city, communities of farmers, hunters, and fishermen stretched for miles, surrounded by fields of corn. With 20,000 residents, no city in the United States would surpass Cahokia's historic size before 1800. Only then would Philadelphia's population eclipse the ancient center.
These people lived in daub and wattle houses on top. The principal people did, the priest and the royalty. They lived in very substantial houses, not teepees, not teepees. Teepees, Western Plains people. Down here they lived in houses. They were sedentary, they were farmers, they used the rivers and the miles and the streams as not only for commerce, but for sustenance as well.
With the Mississippi and other major rivers as its highways, Cahokia was linked by trade to a third of the continent. Copper arrived from the Great Lakes, obsidian from Yellowstone, mica and crystal from the Appalachians, gold and silver from Canada, shell from the Gulf of Mexico.
Look at these old live oak trees that have seen so much pass by them. Magnificently dressed Indian people coming down that bayou in a dugout, greeting people, standing right here on this bank, of having a good time, because they did. You know, Indian people have always known how to have a good time. And there would be a feast prepared. The women would put the corn together. They'd make sofki. They would roast a deer. The people would bring gifts. You never go to an Indian's house without bringing something. That's as old as the sunrise.
Cahokia was the pinnacle of a mound-building culture with traditions dating back to before 1000 BC. Thousands of mounds still dot the landscape from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico. An average funeral mound in the Ohio Valley was 3 stories tall. Construction could represent 200,000 man-hours of labor, or 100 men carrying the baskets of earth for a year. But few mounds compare with the religious effigy located 50 miles east of Cincinnati, Ohio, the Great Serpent Mound. The enormous snake stretches over 400 yards in length. While their earthworks are the mound builder's most visible legacy, their smaller creations are their most beautiful. Only glimpses remain of the people who changed the course of life on the northern continent. Most of their material world, wooden buildings, boats, baskets, woven textiles, leather footwear, and clothes, have long since turned to dust.
An old Caddo relative of mine said that I used to go outside and hold my hands up and bless myself with the sun, a hot. I can't do that anymore because they say we sun worshippers. We didn't worship the sun. We worshiped what was behind it. the power behind it.
In the 19th century, 2,000 miles south of Cahokia, a group of European explorers carved their way into the jungles of southern Mexico. There, buried for centuries and surrounded by massive pyramids, they came upon a royal palace, resplendent with grand rooms, courts, and a tower. The Europeans recognized that by their own standards, the site was a legacy of greatness. Standing in the middle of the largest Indian nation in North America, the Maya, descendants of the pyramid builders, the explorers could not imagine that the towering architecture was the work of Indian people. Instead, they speculated wildly about the lost civilization that could have built so grand an existence. Refugees from the sunken continent of Atlantis, a lost tribe of Israel, seafarers from the Orient, even beings from another planet. They considered everything but the obvious. In 1949, a Mexican archaeologist came to the same magnificent ruins, now known as Palenque. He climbed the steps to the top of the largest pyramid, the Temple of the Inscription. There he noticed holes in the floor below the capstones. He removed the slabs and discovered a rubble-filled passageway descending deep into the pyramid's heart. After 3 years of excavation, the passage was cleared. At the bottom was a tomb that had been buried for over 1,200 years. It would unlock the history of Palenque and help to reveal the past of the Mayan people, a past they left for the future to read. For centuries, Mayan glyphs were considered complex picture stories like Egyptian hieroglyphics. Only in the 1980s did archaeologists finally recognize that it was true writing. They were not looking at pictures to be interpreted, but symbols for sounds to be read. It was the Maya language. Instantly, a door was opened on the past. Beneath the 5-ton sarcophagus cover at Palenque lay Pakal, shield in the Maya language. He was born in 603 AD. His head was bound at birth to enlarge his forehead, a fashion that marked him as a member of the royal elite. He wore a cosmetic bridge on his nose and decorated his hair with water lilies. Pakal rose to power at the age of 12. He would build a holy city and rule for nearly 70 years, leading Palenque during a time of greatness and growth in the Mayan world. As the Maya expanded, over 60 capital cities emerged, their growth fueled by a successful agricultural society. Mayan agriculture reached back thousands of years and stretched across Mexico and into Central America.
Now, friends and brothers, listen to these words of dreaming. Spring rains give us life and bring forth the golden corn silk.
By the time of Christ, there were millions of people in the region, with agriculture allowing populations to settle and expand. Art, mathematics, astronomy, architecture, priesthoods, and royalty all flourished. By the mid-700s, at Palenque alone, the sons of Pakal ruled over 200,000 Maya, living in regional communities of farmers, weavers, stonemasons, and feather workers. But the golden age of building and growth would be transformed by a new era of war and destruction. For reasons still locked in the past, the Mayan world turned against itself. Farmers became soldiers. By 800 AD, an era had ended. Most of the capitals that had been among the living wonders of human creativity, including Palenque, were deserted and reclaimed by the jungle.
South of here, there's a desert. It's a forbidding barrier stretching hundreds of miles. On the other side of that desert is Mexico. Over thousands of years, skilled travelers managed to cross this barrier, but widespread contact was impossible, and so each side developed in their own unique way. In Mexico, millions of Indian people, 80% of the continent's population, created art and architecture that was unparalleled in its sheer size and physical ambition. They developed writing and astronomy. Their wars were waged between massive armies, even by contemporary standards. In this hour, we follow an epic story told through the actual words of those who took part in it, along with eyewitness illustrations of events that occurred almost 500 years ago. We take you to the present-day site of Mexico City, to the heart of the most powerful military empire in the continent's history, the Aztec.
Extended lies the city, lies Mexico, spreading circles of emerald light, radiating splendor like a quetzal plume. O author of life, your house is here. Your song is heard on earth. It spreads among the people. Behold, Mexico.
By the Aztec calendar, it was the year one reed, and Moctezuma, emperor of the Aztec, was the most powerful man in the Americas. By many standards, the most powerful man in the world. From his capital, Tenochtitlan, Moctezuma ruled over 10 million subjects. For almost 90 years, his people had built an empire with their armies, and become rich from the tribute of defeated states. But Motecuzoma was troubled. Prophetic nightmares disturbed his sleep, and he had been reading ominous signs. A huge tongue of fire burning in the night sky to the east. A major temple mysteriously destroyed by fire. A comet blazing across the daytime sky. Signs and dreams were vital to the Aztec. They guided decisions of state.
Motecuzoma thought, as Nahual do in our villages today, that when important things happen, you will dream of it. They too saw things, perhaps in the night sky, a shooting star. Motecuzoma and others at the time would have thought, I have seen it.
Motecuzoma could feel disaster approaching, but he did not know what threatened his empire. He did know that nations lived in cycles, like all things in nature. Growth and fullness were followed by fall. The cycles of nations had been played out many times in the Valley of Mexico. Ruins of ancient cultures were scattered across the region. Motecuzoma had only to look 20 miles to the east to the ruins of a long-abandoned city so magnificent the Aztec called it the home of the gods. In the cycle of nations, even the home of the gods had fallen. Years before Motecuzoma, workers had come from throughout Mexico to build Teotihuacan. The city, among the grandest in the world, was a monumental work of art. Its largest building, the Pyramid of the Sun, had a base the size of the biggest pyramid in Egypt. Teotihuacan's military might controlled central Mexico for centuries.
When I first saw this place, Teotihuacan, and the pyramids, I thought, this is truly beautiful, that which our grandfathers, our fathers before, have done. And I thought, when I looked at it again, it is like having your father that died, or your brother that died, and meeting them again here. You remember them, and you see their greatness when you contemplate what they left behind.
With all its power, Teotihuacan was still trapped in the cycle of nations. In one of history's great unsolved mysteries, the city was systematically burned and abandoned at its height. With the dissolving of the empire, central Mexico turned to chaos, with small rival kingdoms locked in a struggle for power and survival. Elite warriors fought for kings on the field of honor, like knights in medieval Europe. It was a world of royal bloodlines, betrayal, and revenge. In central Mexico, the small kingdoms would struggle for 200 years before the cycle would turn again, and they would begin to unify under the leadership of the Toltec people from the city-state of Tolan. Over 500 years before the rise of the Aztec, the Toltec redefined leadership in central Mexico, enforcing power not through military might, but through the moral force of their teachings. They coordinated trade between states and arbitrated disputes, all within the framework of their religion. Their capital functioned like Wall Street, the Vatican, and the Supreme Court combined. It was also here, in Tolan, that a priest who held the name of the god Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, would be exiled, eventually sailing into the Gulf of Mexico, vowing to return in another time as a savior for the people. After less than two centuries, Tolan, like Teotihuacan before it, was violently destroyed. But while the city burned, the sophisticated Toltec leadership escaped, many of the elite families moving to the Valley of Mexico. For 150 years, in the shadows of the ruins of Teotihuacan, the Toltec established control over the city-states of the valley. Their influence was so great that their bloodlines became the benchmark of nobility throughout the region. During the same time, a nomadic tribe far to the west was in the midst of an epic search for a homeland. They were the Mexica, Moctezuma's ancestors.
Behold, a new sun is risen, a new god is born, new laws are written, and new men are made.
Around 1300, after nearly two centuries of wandering, the Mexica people came to the Valley of Mexico, a valley long dominated by the Toltec. The Mexica, with no Toltec blood, were seen by the refined city-states as violent barbarians, a threat to the stability of the valley. The local states attacked the nomad nation, killing many and driving the survivors to a rocky area covered with cactus and infested with snakes. The exile was meant to destroy them. But the Mexica were used to adversity. They flourished. Soon their resilience and skills in warfare impressed their sophisticated neighbors. They began to sell their services as mercenaries, and within a generation, the Mexica were accepted as part of the social and political fabric of the lush mountain valley. In 1325, they asked the neighboring lord of Colhuacan to send his daughter to become the wife of a Mexica ruler. Flattered and seeing the opportunity for unity, the lord of Colhuacan complied. Days later, when he and the other lords of the valley went to the Mexica town to honor the new princess, instead of seeing his young child emerge, a priest appeared, dressed in her skin. Horrified, the lord of Colhuacan called for revenge.
Here. Come here, my vassals from Colhuacan. Come avenge the hideous crime committed by these Mexica. Let them die. Destroy them, such depraved men of evil. My vassals, we shall finish them off and leave no trace or memory of them.
Colhuacan and its allies attacked the Mexica, driving those they did not kill into a lake in the center of the valley. Almost annihilated, the Mexica again proved resilient. As they gathered on a swampy island in the lake, they saw an eagle perch on a cactus. The prophetic sign they were told they would see when they reached the end of their long search for a homeland. The place that would be called Tenochtitlan.
Now we have found the land promised to us. We have found peace for the weary Mexican people. Now we want for nothing. Be comforted, children, brothers and sisters, because we have obtained the promise of our God.
For 100 years, the people of Tenochtitlan built up the island through great sacrifice. They reclaimed land from the swampy lake and erected stone temples and public buildings. Causeways of hewn stone were constructed to the north, south, and west. An aqueduct was built to bring in fresh water from a mainland spring 3 miles away. Canals were dug throughout the island to transport goods and people. They gained trade wealth and again hired themselves out as mercenary soldiers for the powerful city-states of the valley. Marriages were arranged that finally brought them honored Toltec bloodlines. Tenochtitlan was a city on the rise. The cycle of power was turning toward the Mexica. And when war again broke out in the valley, the Mexica and their allies prevailed. In victory, they called themselves the Aztec, after the Mexica place of origin, Aztlan, land of the herons. From this point, Aztec prophecy foretold a glorious future.
The might of our powerful arms and the spirit of our hearts shall be felt. With them we will conquer all nations near and far, rule over all villages and cities from sea to sea, become lords of gold and silver, jewels and precious stones, feathers and tributes. And we shall become lords over them and their lands, and over their sons and their daughters, who will serve us as our subjects.
For over 80 years, the Aztec launched far-reaching campaigns of conquest, expanding their domain from Gulf to Pacific. They fought epic battles with city-states throughout the region. Most were conquered and turned into tributaries, forced to supply slave laborers for Aztec public works and pay high taxes in goods. Aztec scribes recorded the taxes of many states. Bolts of fine cloth, of hammered gold, exotic plants and feathers, precious stones, feathered military uniforms. Built on the backs of the tributary states, the island capital of the Aztec grew into one of the wonders of the world.
When I first opened my eyes in this world, I was born of this heritage. I have seen the beautiful festivals we have in our villages, our dances, and it would have been like that there. They had many festivals in this place, with many beautiful dancers, wearing many brilliant colors. I think it was even more beautiful then, much more beautiful when our grandfathers lived there and followed their ways.
The two-story houses of the elite were adorned with beautiful gardens. Royal aviaries housed thousands of rare birds, and storehouses swelled with the wealth of empire. The city was cleaned daily by thousands of sweepers, its refuse collected and shipped away on barges. The central markets thronged with professional traders whose travels took them to far distant locations, men who spoke many languages and often carried with them news of the world. The center of Tenochtitlan was dominated by the great temple, its twin pyramids representing deities who embodied the conflict at the heart of Aztec society. The eternal struggle between life and death, fertility and war. Their private rituals, which on special occasions included the sacrifice of human prisoners, incorporated this duality. Life required death to exist, and death required life. Tenochtitlan became a city of hundreds of thousands, a bustling metropolis ruled by the Aztec emperor from the Grand Imperial Palace. But in the year one reed, the Christian year 1519, Moctezuma could feel a shadow across his empire. And he could not forget that the prophecy of Aztec greatness had a dark side, a prophecy long held in their oral tradition.
I shall make war against all provinces and cities, towns and settlements, and make all of them my subjects, my servants. But just as I will subjugate them, so too will they be snatched from me and turned against me by strangers who will drive me out of this land.
Ever since their years as a wandering tribe, the Aztec believed their destiny was to rule the world. Now, at the height of empire, Moctezuma listened to his dreams and saw the signs. They foretold disaster. Then word came of strange happenings in the east. Boats and men landing on the Mexican coast. Men unlike any they had encountered before. Their bodies sheathed in metal. Moctezuma sent scouts to the coast to find out more about the new arrivals.
They were very white. Their eyes were like chalk. Their hair, on some it was yellow, and on some it was black. They wore long beards. They were yellow, too.
The strangers had landed on the Gulf Coast. That was also disturbing information. Centuries earlier, the banished priest from the cult of the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, had left Mexico from the same coast, promising one day to return. Another prophecy that threatened Moctezuma.
If he comes in the year one reed, he strikes at kings.
It was now the Aztec year one reed. Whether Moctezuma believed the prophecy or not was of little importance. He knew that many subjugated people throughout the empire embraced the story of the feathered serpent and awaited his return.
For it was in their hearts that he would come. That he would come to land to reclaim his kingdom.
Whoever these invaders were, whether they represented Quetzalcoatl or a foreign power, Moctezuma could feel the threat to his empire. And his fears were justified. Spanish conquistador Hernando Cortes had landed in Mexico.
It was said that first he dreamt that Quetzalcoatl would return. After that, when he saw Hernán Cortés and the others, he thought, he has come. Quetzalcoatl has come. Only he was wrong. Another had come. Someone with evil intentions. Because Cortés did not come with religious faith or to do good things. He came to commit terrible crimes against the Mexica.
As a diplomatic gesture, Moctezuma sent emissaries carrying the costume of Quetzalcoatl, which they presented to Cortes aboard his ship. Cortes responded with a display of force. He ordered the Aztec delegation shackled and forced to watch as his men fired a Lombard cannon in a thunderous hail of fire and smoke, blowing apart a tree on shore. The astonished emissaries were released, and they raced back to Tenochtitlan. Moctezuma received the news with alarm. Spanish weapons and armor were formidable, and it would be only a matter of time before tributary states, chafing under the yoke of Aztec oppression, would join the conquistador. They would lead him to the wealth that lay at the center of the empire, to the one thing Spanish conquistadors craved above all else.
We Spanish suffer from a disease of the heart, which only gold can cure.
Cortes ordered his 450-man army inland. When some of his men resisted, he sank his ships. There would be no turning back. The army moved relentlessly toward the Valley of Mexico. As Moctezuma had anticipated, Cortes formed alliances along the way with rebellious city-states. One tributary leader spoke for the fears of many.
Moctezuma and the Mexica have given us much pain. They have imposed a tribute upon us. They have become our rulers. If the Spaniards should abandon us in haste, if they should go, so perverse are the Mexica that they will kill us.
While many nations lived in fear of the Aztec, one city-state less than 50 miles east of Tenochtitlan had never fallen to the empire. Tlaxcala. There, Cortes forged his key alliance. 6,000 Tlaxcalan troops joined the Spaniards. As reports reached the Aztec capital, some of Moctezuma's advisors argued for a decisive military campaign. But Moctezuma held his armies in check, unwilling to leave the capital unprotected or risk setting off a general rebellion. Stalling for time, he sent emissaries to protest Cortes's advance, and even had a wall of trees planted across the road to disguise the route to Tenochtitlan. Paralyzed with doubt, the emperor was fast becoming only a player in a prophecy being fulfilled.
And he must have thought, these men, why have they come? What do they want? Maybe we can attack and kill some of them, but not all of them. For that reason, some did not want to fight. They had seen that if they shot arrows at them, they did not fall. They made a clanging sound as they bounced off their armor. Even if they fired at the horses, they did not die, because the horses had armor.
Cortes and the Tlaxcalan army turned first to a city-state that remained loyal to the Aztec emperor, Cholula. Eyewitness accounts were recorded.
Then there arose from the Spaniards a cry, summoning all the noblemen, lords, war leaders, warriors, and common folk. And when they had crowded into the temple courtyard, then the Spaniards and their allies blocked the entrances and every exit. There followed a butchery of stabbing, beating, killing of the unsuspecting Cholulans, armed with no bows and arrows, protected by no shields. With no warning, they were treacherously, deceitfully slain.
6,000 Cholulan citizens lay dead in the streets. Tenochtitlan received the news of the massacre in shock. An Aztec eyewitness later recalled,
the city rose in tumult, alarmed, as if by an earthquake, as if there were a constant reeling of the face of the earth.
Moctezuma's worst nightmare was about to reveal itself.
Do the former rulers know what is happening in their absence? Oh, that any of them might see, might wonder at what has befallen me, at what I am seeing now that they have gone. For I cannot be dreaming.
Proudly stands the city of Mexico, Tenochtitlan. Here no one fears to die in war. Keep this in mind, O princes. Who could attack Tenochtitlan? Who could shake the foundations of heaven?
On November 8, 1519, in the Aztec year, one read, Hernando Cortes arrived at the gates to the imperial city of the Aztec Empire, Tenochtitlan. An Aztec eyewitness later recalled.
Mexico lay stunned, silent. None went out of doors. Mothers kept their children in. The roads were deserted, as if it were early morning.
Moctezuma walked out onto the Grand Causeway. Coming face to face with Cortes, the emperor offered his hospitality, leading the Spaniards through the city gates to his imperial palace. The people of Tenochtitlan watched, and their words were remembered.
The iron of their lances glistened from afar. The shimmer of their swords was as of a sinuous watercourse. Their iron breast and back pieces, their helmets, clanked. Some came completely encased in iron, as if turned to iron. And ahead of them ran their dogs, panting, with foam continually dripping from their muzzles.
The Spanish soldiers were themselves struck with awe.
We were astounded. The majestic towers and houses, all of massive stone and rising out of the waters, were like enchanted castles we had read of in books. Indeed, some of our men even asked if what we saw was not a dream.
Even Cortes was amazed.
Considering that these people are barbarous, lacking the knowledge of God and cut off from all civilized nations, it is truly remarkable to see what they have achieved.
Once they reached the palace, Moctezuma's diplomatic plans were shattered. Cortes turned on his host, seizing the emperor hostage.
What now, my warriors? We have come to the end. We have taken our medicine. Is there anywhere a mountain we can run away to and climb?
Moctezuma was forced to lead Cortes to the treasury.
Moctezuma's own property was then brought out. Precious things like necklaces with pendants, armbands tufted with quetzal feathers, golden armbands, bracelets, golden anklets with shells, turquoise diadems, turquoise nose rods, no end of treasure. They took all, seized everything for themselves, as if it were theirs.
Cortes wrote to the King of Spain.
Your Highness, there is so much to describe that I do not know how to begin even to recount some part of it. Moctezuma has all the things to be found under the heavens, fashioned in gold and silver.
The Spaniards melted the beautifully crafted gold into blocks. For 5 months, holding Moctezuma prisoner in his own palace, they lived in splendor and pillaged the city from within.
They thought, this isn't Quetzalcoatl. This isn't a god. They said, look at them, how they eat just as we do. Look at them, they go about just as we. When they saw him, they knew he wasn't really Quetzalcoatl. They said among themselves to their people, "Look, brothers, this isn't a god. Our gods do good things, and this one, he wants to destroy us."
Among the Aztec people, a resistance began to organize under the direction of Moctezuma's brother, Cuitlahuac. In an effort to cripple the movement, the Spaniards attacked a large, unarmed religious gathering in April of 1520. One man, who saved his life by playing dead, later recounted the scene.
"They charged the crowd with their iron lances and hacked us with their iron swords. They slashed the backs of some. They hacked at the shoulders of others, splitting their bodies open. The blood of the young warriors ran like water. It gathered in pools. And the Spaniards began to hunt them out of the administrative building, dragging and killing anyone they could find, even starting to take those buildings to pieces as they searched."
The Aztec counterattacked, forcing the conquistadors to retreat behind the walls of the great palace. The Spaniards then brought Moctezuma out in chains before his people to order them to stop fighting. But the emperor could not bring himself to speak. He stood by while another hostage delivered his message.
"Mexicans, men of Tenochtitlan, your ruler, the Lord of Men, Moctezuma, implores you. He says, 'Listen, Mexicans, we are not equal to the Spaniards. Abandon the battle. Still your arrows. Hold back your shields. Otherwise, evil will be the fate of the miserable old men and women, of the people, of babes in arms, of the toddlers, of the infants crawling on the ground or still in the cradle.'"
But the Aztec were not a people to be subjugated. They reformed their government and elected Moctezuma's brother, Cuitlahuac, as the 10th emperor. Under his direction, the Aztec continued the siege of the palace. After 30 days, Moctezuma was killed. The Aztec accused the Spaniards of strangling him and hurling his body from the top of the palace. The Spaniards claimed he was stoned to death by his own people. One of the most powerful men on earth had fallen, trapped in a play of destiny. Prophecy had become reality. Days later, the Spaniards, trapped in the palace without food or water, attempted to escape under cover of darkness. Aztec witnesses recounted the events.
"That night at midnight, the enemy came out, crowded together. The Spaniards in the lead, Tlaxcalans following, screened by a fine drizzle, a fine sprinkle of rain. They were able, undetected, to cross the canals. Just as they were crossing the canal, a woman drawing water saw them. 'Mexicas, come all of you. They are already leaving. They are already secretly getting out.' Then a watcher at the top of a temple also shouted, and his cries pervaded the entire cities. 'Brave warriors, Mexicas, your enemy already leaves. Hurry with the shield boats and along the road.'"
As the Spaniards moved out onto one of the main causeways over the lake, canoe after canoe full of Aztec soldiers under Cuitlahuac's direction
showered them with spears and arrows. Many Spaniards, weighted down with gold stolen from the palace, fell into the water and drowned, carried to the bottom by the weight.
The canal was filled, crammed with them. Those who came along behind walked on corpses. It was as if a mountain of men had been laid down. They had pressed against one another, smothered one another.
3/4 of the Spanish army never reached the outskirts of Tenochtitlan. Cortes and the rest of the survivors escaped into the countryside. For a moment, the great city was free.
And when the Spaniards thus disappeared, we thought they had gone for good, never more to return. Once again, the temples could be swept out, the dirt removed, they could be adorned, ornamented.
But the fleeing Spaniards left behind another enemy, an Aztec survivor, remember.
At about the time that the Spaniards had fled from the city, there came a great sickness, a pestilence, the smallpox. It spread over the people with great destruction of men. It caused great misery. The brave Mexica warriors were indeed weakened by it.
Even the new emperor died of the disease.
It was after all this had happened that the Spaniards came back.
Cortes and his men had healed their wounds and rebuilt their army. New alliances were made. The Spaniards and 75,000 Tlaxcalan and allied Indian soldiers set siege to Tenochtitlan. The entire population rose to defend their city. Aztec witnesses would remember the struggle.
Fighting continued. Both sides took captives. On both sides, there were deaths. Great became the suffering of the common folk. There was hunger. Many died of famine. There was no more good, pure water to drink. Many died of it. The people ate anything. Lizards, barn swallows, corn leaves, salt grass. Never had such suffering been seen. The enemy pressed about us like a wall. They herded us. The brave warriors were still hopelessly resisting.
After 2.5 long months, the Spaniards, with their overwhelming numbers, brought Tenochtitlan to its knees.
Finally, the battle just quietly ended. Silence reigned. Nothing happened. All was quiet and nothing more took place. Night fell, and the next day nothing happened either. No one spoke aloud. The people were crushed.
Great was the stench of the dead. Your grandfathers died, and with them died the son of the king and his brothers and kinsmen. So it was that we became orphans, O my sons. So we became when we were young. All of us were thus. We were born to die.
Tenochtitlan was leveled. The magnificent gardens, the marvel of their world, were destroyed. The rivers and canals that so amazed the Spaniards were filled in. Then Cortes set fire to the aviaries. Thousands of birds, vermilion flycatchers, iridescent hummingbirds, scarlet tanagers, green and blue macaws. The beauty that was Mexico was turned to ashes.
Some say the Mexica came to an end. It's gone, finished. We're still here. We, the people who ignorant outsiders insult by calling us Indians, we are here. This culture was not finished off. The culture is gone as an empire, as a social, political, religious structure. But what remains is what the people have. We weren't finished off.
Proudly stands the city of Mexico, Tenochtitlan. Here no one fears to die in war. Keep this in mind, O princes. Who could attack Tenochtitlan? Who could shake the foundations of heaven?
Our next program will begin far to the east of Mexico, on a Caribbean island where a meeting between Spanish and Indian people appeared at first glance to be merely an encounter between two potential trading partners. But that first encounter between Christopher Columbus and the Taino people in 1492 was in reality a world-shattering event. Please join us for 500 Nations, A Clash of Cultures. Hello, I'm Kevin Costner. Welcome back to 500 Nations. The first encounters between Europeans and Indian people are some of the most famous and important events in world history. Most of us can recite the names of Christopher Columbus's ships, the year he first landed in the New World, and how he mistakenly called the people he encountered their Indians. But few of us know the names of the people who greeted Columbus, or much about the lives they led. How did they greet the strangers? Were they treated like gods? Were they feared? Were they attacked? Or were they treated as a new and exotic trading partner by a people who had a long history of dealing with other seafaring cultures? The first meeting between European and American worlds would bring two very different cultures into conflict. We take you now to the Caribbean, where the rough road of contact begins. 500 Nations continues with A Clash of Cultures.
How much damage, how many calamities, disruptions, and devastations of kingdoms have there been? How many souls have perished in the Indies over the years, and how unjustly? How many unforgivable sins have been committed? Bartolomé de las Casas.
In December of 1492, three ships, under the command of Christopher Columbus, approached the second largest island in the Caribbean. For 8 weeks, Columbus had traveled from the Bahamas to Cuba, finally reaching the site of modern-day Haiti and the Dominican Republic, the island he would name Hispaniola. The island was then populated by people known as the Taino. One region was controlled by the paramount chief, Bocanegarí. On Christmas Eve, while coasting along the shore, Columbus's flagship, the Santa Maria, ran aground.
When Bocanegarí learned the news, he sent all his people from the town with many large canoes to unload everything from the ship. So great was the care and diligence which that king exercised, and he himself was as diligent unloading the ship as in guarding what was taken to land, in order that everything would be well cared for.
Grateful for the island leader's help, Columbus accepted his invitation to come ashore.
The admiral left to dine on shore and arrived at the time when five kings had come, all subject to the one who is called Bocanegarí. Bocanegarí came to receive the admiral as soon as he had reached land and took him by the arm.
Columbus was immediately struck by the beauty of Taino life.
The king observes a very wonderful estate in such a dignified manner that it is a pleasure to see. Neither better people nor land can there be. The houses and the villages are so pretty. They love their neighbors as themselves. And they have the sweetest speech in the world. And they are gentle and they are always laughing. Christopher Columbus.
As a token of gratitude for the rescue of his men and supplies, Columbus presented Bocanegarí with a red cape, a prestigious item among the Taino elite. In return, Bocanegarí gave Columbus a golden tiara he wore on his head. To Bocanegarí, it was a fair exchange, a gesture of mutual respect and recognition, the opening of trade between equals. To Columbus, it was a crown, a symbol of authority. Bocanegarí was surrendering his lands and people to Spain. But Columbus was not simply looking to rule people. He saw something much more valuable to his future. He saw gold. the prize he could take back to his sponsors in Europe. There was wealth to be had, and to the Europeans of the time, wealth belonged to those strong enough to take it.
Now, I have ordered my men to build a tower and a fort. Not that I believe it to be necessary, for it is obvious that with these men that I bring, I could subdue all of this island, since the people are naked and without arms. But it is right that this tower be made, so that with love and fear, they will obey.
Leaving behind a contingent of men in a fort built from the timbers of the Santa Maria, Columbus set sail for Europe. With him, he would carry the news of a new world, gold, and docile island natives. Wakanagari and the Taino had no way of knowing what was about to happen to their ancient way of life. The Taino's ancestors were part of a series of migrations of South American Indian people dating back over 2,000 years. They farmed the land and harvested the wealth of the sea. Taino traders traveled in huge ocean-going canoes capable of carrying up to 150 men. Boats laden with feathers, gold, wood, pottery, beautiful birds, cotton fabric, and food. Island nations were woven together by trade. Trade was the communication system by which nations knew one another and maintained peace. Some trading partners even exchanged their names to create lasting bonds between their communities. By the time of contact, there were well over 1 million people living in the Caribbean. Local community leaders were subject to powerful regional leaders like Wakanagari, who controlled trade with large personal fleets and warehouses of commodities. Into this world, Columbus returned in November 1493 with a military flotilla of 17 ships. Under his command were armor-clad soldiers, mounted cavalry, attack dogs, and guns. The Spanish conquest of the Caribbean began. Gold mines were opened, and the Taino were enslaved, forced to mine the ore. A Spanish priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, who accompanied Columbus on his second voyage, spoke out against the cruel treatment of the Taino people.
It is not possible to recount the hundredth part of what I have seen with my own eyes. A man had need to have a body of iron to undergo the labor they endure in getting gold out of the mines. They must delve and search 100 times over in the inner parts of the mountains till they dig them down from top to bottom. They must work the very rocks hollow. Bartolomé de las Casas.
Epidemics and famine swept the island. Yet the Spanish continued to demand that the beleaguered Taino supply them with both food and labor. Garrisons were strung across the island to fortify the gold fields. When resistance sprang up, Columbus sent out military units to terrorize towns into submission.
They were so relentlessly persecuted and pursued with their wives and children up into the hills, so tired, hungry, and harassed. And there went with them disease, death, and misery, just as if they had been killed in the wars. They died of hunger and sickness that surrounded them, and the fatigue and oppression that followed. After 1496, no more than a third remained of the multitude that had been on the island.
Taino's suffering was so severe that thousands took their own lives rather than submit.
Wherefore many went to the woods and there hung themselves, after having killed the children, saying it was far better to die than to live so miserably. Some threw themselves from the high cliffs down precipices, others jumped into the sea, and others starved themselves to death. Benzoni, soldier for Spain.
Some escaped into the mountains, including Guacanagari, the paramount chief who had befriended Columbus. He soon died, a homeless wanderer. By 1503, 11 years after Columbus's first voyage, only a few pockets of resistance remained. In the mountainous region of Charawa, Taino people ruled by a woman named Anacaona successfully evaded Spanish demands for labor. Determined to break the resistance, the Spanish governor requested a diplomatic meeting. Anacaona agreed and summoned 80 regional subchiefs to her state house for the meeting. When the 80 leaders were gathered inside, the governor gave a signal and the thatched state house was set on fire. Soldiers lined up outside with swords. Taino leaders who did not burn were killed as they fled the blaze. Anacaona was spared, only to be later executed by hanging. In the aftermath of the bloody carnage, a little boy stood among the ashes and smoke beside the charred remains of his father. A boy whose name the Spanish would come to remember well, Enrique. The child who witnessed the murder of his father and the other Taino leaders in Charawa was taken away from the killing field by a Spanish priest. He was placed in the care of missionaries and baptized Enrique. Although raised by Spaniards, he never forgot his own identity, heir to the chiefdom of the Bahoruco region of the island.
Enrique was a tall and graceful man with a well-proportioned body. His face was neither handsome nor ugly, but that of a serious and stern man. He married a native, a woman of excellent and noble lineage, named Doña Lucia, Bartolomé de las Casas.
The Spanish government created a labor grant system under which individual Spanish landholders were given village populations to use as forced labor. Enrique, his wife, and his people were turned over to a debauched young Spaniard named Valenzuela. They were at his mercy. The priest, Las Casas, protested.
In a more just world, Enrique would have been the master. Valenzuela viewed Enriquillo as a slave and valued him less than manure in the street.
Enrique complied with Valenzuela's tyrannical demands, for which he was rewarded with regular beatings and robbed of his last remaining possessions. His many appeals to Spanish authorities fell on deaf ears. When Valenzuela raped his wife, Enrique reached his breaking point. He and his followers escaped to their homelands in the lofty Bahoruco Mountains.
The Spanish came to call him the Rebel Enrique, and those who followed him were termed rebels and insurgents, although in truth they were not rebelling, but only fleeing from their cruel enemies who were misusing and destroying them, just as a cow or an ox tries to escape from the slaughterhouse. Bartolomé de las Casas.
Enrique organized his people. Women, children, and elderly were sent into caves high in the mountains, where they raised chickens and cultivated gardens to feed the resistance army. Scouts were posted on every crag and pass. Heavy boulders rolled into place above the footpaths. Enrique instructed his men to fight only in self-defense, to kill Spaniards only in the course of battle, and otherwise to simply deprive them of their arms. At first, the Spanish army was confident they would quickly crush the Taino resistance. But Enrique's people, armed only with spears, iron spikes, fish bones, and bows and arrows, fought with fierce determination against the Spanish and their sophisticated arms. Time after time, they forced the enemy to retreat. During one fierce battle, Valenzuela himself was captured. But even this mortal enemy's life would be spared. Enrique ordered him released. As word of Enrique's victory spread across the island, many Taino fled to his refuge and joined the fight for freedom. His legend grew. It was said that Enrique never slept at night, that he himself patrolled the village until dawn. For over a decade, he fought Spain to a standstill. Finally, unable to defeat the guerrillas on their own territory, an exhausted and humiliated Spanish government made overtures of peace.
I know the Spanish very well, because they killed my father and grandfather and all the people of the Kingdom of Charawa and reduced the population of the entire island of Española. I have fled to my own land, where neither I nor any of my followers are harming anyone, but are simply defending ourselves against those who came to capture and kill us. I need not talk to another Spaniard. Enrique, Taino.
But there was one Spaniard to whom Enrique would still talk, the priest, Las Casas. After many years spent demanding the king act to stop Spanish atrocities in the New World, Las Casas had been officially designated protector of the Indians. He now sought out Enrique in his mountain stronghold. 2 months later, Las Casas and Enrique appeared before Spanish authorities and negotiated a truce. 14 years after it began, the rebellion came to an end, but only after the Spanish agreed to guarantee freedom for Enrique's people. At the base of the Cibao Mountains, Enrique settled with his 4,000 followers, the last members of a culture that had flourished for millennia. By the end of the century, the Taino population that Las Casas had estimated at 2 million was officially reported extinct.
What does the name DeSoto mean to me? It means the personification of evil.
In the late spring of 1539, less than 50 years after Columbus, less than 20 years after the fall of the Aztec Empire, Spanish conquistador Hernando de Soto landed on the West Florida coast north of present-day Tampa Bay. He rode at the head of a 600-man army, 200 mounted. They were supported by 100 servants, herds of horses, pack animals, swine, and trained attack dogs. Unable to carry the quantity of food needed to support the massive expedition, De Soto would feed his men and animals on the bounty of the towns they entered. The invaders came prepared to take their provisions by force. In July, De Soto struck north into the lands of the Timucua people, chiefdoms of fishermen and farmers scattered across the northern Florida peninsula. One by one, villages were plundered by the marauding army. Indian people were enslaved as burden bearers, chained together with iron neck collars in groups of 30.
If they were men of virtue, they would not have left their own country. They have made highwaymen, adulterers, and murderers of themselves, without shame of men or fear of any god. Timucua.
But the Timucua were people who also knew of war. As the Spanish army advanced, news reached one leader, Urrutia, who was secure in a military strength that had never failed him. As the Spanish force neared Urrutia's town, De Soto sent a messenger ahead with a warning to submit or be destroyed. Urrutia responded.
I am king in my land. I and all of my people have vowed to die 100 deaths to maintain the freedom of our land. This is our answer, both for the present and forevermore.
De Soto entered Urrutia's town with his army in battle formation. But oddly, they met no resistance. The chief, who had promised such defiance, seemed to have completely submitted. But the surface belied the reality. While the Spaniards gorged upon the town's food stores, Urrutia secretly summoned fighting men from throughout the region. Then, playing out a military chess game, the young chief invited De Soto to witness Timucua military maneuvers in a large field. His plan? To amass his army and launch a surprise attack on the Spanish force. But De Soto had been forewarned by a spy. Matching the Indian leader move for move, he brought his army to the field in battle formation. To the rear of the Timucua force were two lakes. To their flanks were forest, and in front of them, the Spanish army. Suddenly, De Soto gave a signal. Urrutia was seized, and the Spaniards attacked. Spanish cavalry thundered forward, their horses' hooves driving into the Timucuan ranks. Outmatched, the Indian force fell back. Some ran towards the shelter of the trees. Hundreds more plunged into the lake nearby, swimming out into the deep water to evade their pursuers. The Spaniards fired into the lake, trying to force the Timucua to surrender. Indian resistors had to tread water constantly, but by nightfall, not a single man had yielded. A Spanish chronicler observed the agonizing struggle.
And now, they continued to torment the Indians, never once letting them set foot on the shore, hoping that they would become exhausted by the swimming, and as a result, give up the more quickly. Thus, they threatened with death those who would not surrender. Regardless of how much the Castilians afflicted them, they could not do enough to keep them from showing their spirit and strength. For even though these men realized that they were without hope of help in the hardships and danger they were experiencing, some chose death as a lesser evil.
It was not until late the following morning that 200 survivors surrendered in a body.
They had been swimming 24 hours, and it was a great pity to see them emerge from the lagoon, half-drowned and swollen and transfixed by the toil, hunger, fatigue, and lack of sleep they had suffered. Garcilaso de la Vega, Spanish chronicler.
The remaining seven were dragged out of the water at knife point by De Soto's men. The Timucuan prisoners were chained and distributed among the Spanish soldiers as slaves. Urrutia was imprisoned inside his own state house. He would make one last act of defiance. Pretending to have passively accepted his defeat, he lulled De Soto within his reach. Suddenly, he lunged at the Spanish leader, smashing his face with chained fists.
The chief gave out such a tremendous roar that it could be heard for a quarter of a league around. The blow was so fierce that De Soto was unconscious for more than half an hour, and he bled through the eyes, nose, and mouth.
Simultaneously, Urrutia was gored by 12 swordsmen. Outside, the Timucua fell upon their captors, fighting with stones, pots of boiling food, anything at hand. The Spaniards turned upon them, killing indiscriminately.
They were valiant and spirited people, and had they found themselves free, would have done more harm. With all that, imprisoned as they were, they tried to do everything they could. And for this reason, the Spaniards killed each of them, not permitting a single one to live, which was a great pity.
In a certain way, I feel like the land has a memory of its own, and the memory of the suffering can still be felt in the southeastern United States. You can go into sites where Indian villages, and even we might say cities, once were, and you can see the ruins, you can see the mounds where people were buried, and you don't see the people. And you know immediately there was a great and tragic story there. So I think that the story still lives, even if it's not in our history books, it's in the land itself.
Having laid waste to the Timucua, De Soto marched his army north. In the spring of 1540, he approached a town near present-day Columbia, South Carolina. Cofetachequi, a farming community with a religious and social heritage reaching back to the ancient mound builders. The army's approach was monitored by the people of Kafita Cheki. They hid what they could of their food stores and sent their elderly chiefess away to a town removed from DeSoto's path. When DeSoto reached the bank of the watery river, the niece of the old chiefess crossed the river to meet him. Relying on diplomacy rather than military force, she hoped to persuade the Spaniard to spare her people.
The mistress of her town and eight of her ladies embarked in a canoe, which had been covered with a great canopy and adorned with ornaments. It was towed by a second one which bore six principal Indians and many oarsmen. In this manner, they all crossed the river. The mistress of Kofita Cheki came before De Soto and, after paying her respects, seated herself upon a chair which her subjects had brought for her. She alone spoke with the governor.
Excellent Lord, although my possibility does not equal my wishes, for goodwill is more worthy than all the treasures of the world which may be offered without it. With very sincere and open goodwill, I offer you my person, my lands, my vassals, and this poor service.
Unwrapping a great strand of pearls from her neck, she presented them to De Soto. Struck with admiration, De Soto called her the Lady of Kofita Cheki. But her generosity and graciousness would not prevent the plunder of her town. The Spaniards feasted on 600 bushels of corn. They looted the graves and temples for pearls. Then De Soto demanded that the old chiefess be summoned from hiding to gain her submission. Finally, a 21-year-old adopted son of the chiefess was pressed into leading the army to her. The Spaniards marched out of town behind the young guide, stopping some time later in the forest to eat.
He began to grow morose and to sit contemplatively with his hand on his cheek. He gave some long and profound sighs. Then, as he sat in the midst of the Spaniards, he began to remove his arrows one at a time and very slowly. Observing that the Castilians were not watching him, he struck himself in the gullet in such a way as to inflict a mortal wound, and thus died instantly.
When the Indian bearers were asked why the boy had taken his life, they explained.
He realized that the act of guiding these people to his mother's present location was unworthy of the love she bore him.
The elderly chiefess remained undiscovered. But before resuming his march, De Soto took her young niece, the Lady of Kofita Cheki, as his hostage. After days of traveling west, she managed a daring escape, even recovering some of the plundered pearls. De Soto would not pursue her. He moved on, crossing the Appalachian Mountains. In July, he traveled down a broad river into the territory of the Coosa, what is now northern Alabama. The Spaniards were amazed by the size and wealth of the Coosa nation, where a single day's march took them through 12 towns, each surrounded by vast fields of crops. When they reached the Coosa capital, they were met on the road by 1,000 men wearing great feathered headdresses and bearing their young chief on a litter. After replenishing their supplies, De Soto and his men departed without serious incident. With them, they would take stories of Coosa wealth that would become legendary in Spain. As the army headed west, they left behind one man too sick to travel, a decision that would shatter the Coosa world. On October 18, 1540, De Soto arrived at the fortified town of Movila, in the territory of the powerful Mobile Nation. The Mobile had been preparing for this moment. Inside a strong defensive wall replete with towers, a war council was in progress. Upon the arrival of the Spaniards, a man described as a Captain General was sent out to confront them.
Who are these thieves and vagabonds who keep shouting, "Come forth, come forth," with as little consideration as if they were talking with some such person as themselves? No one can endure longer the insolence of these demons, and it is therefore only right that they die today, torn into pieces for their infamy, and that in this way an end be given to their wickedness and tyranny.
As he finished speaking, the Captain General was struck down with a Spanish sword. Instantly, thousands of Mobile fighters spilled out, driving back the Spaniards, fighting so fiercely they even grabbed the cavaliers' lances by the blades.
The Indians fought with so great spirit that they drove us outside again and again. Elvas, Spanish chronicler.
But the Spanish soldiers broke through the town's fortifications with battle axes and drove the Mobile inside their homes. De Soto ordered the houses set on fire. Wind fanned the flames, engulfing the town in thick smoke, while De Soto kept the trumpets, fifes, and drums blaring. And yet, the Mobile battled ever more desperately. Women fought frantically beside the men, prompting one Spanish soldier to say, "They fought with a desire to die." Finally, at sunset, after 9 hours of battle, it ended. Eyewitness estimates of the Mobile dead ranged up to 11,000. Bodies littered the streets between the charred remains of buildings. Even the Spaniards reeled in shock. One soldier emerged from the silent